Servus and greetings from Vienna. My name is Anita Posch. Thank you for listening to Bitcoin und Co., my podcast that's introducing the philosophy, ideas and people behind Bitcoin. Before we start, a message from my sponsors. The card wallet is the ideal solution to store your Bitcoin keys in the medium and long run. No software updates needed, it's 100% offline, it leaves no traces on the blockchain if you give it away as a gift or inheritance. With the card wallet, you'll get one Bitcoin address, you can send Bitcoin to it whenever you wish, and all you have to do is to store it in a safe place. That's it. The manufacturers are the Austrian State Printing House, who is also the producer of Austria's passports, and Coinfinity, Austria's first Bitcoin broker. Order your card wallet at cardwallet.com/Anita and get 20% off. Hello, people, and welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin and Co. podcast. Today's guest is Pascal Hügli. Pascal is from Switzerland, and he's a journalist, moderator, lecturer, and he calls himself a lifelong student. Hi, Pascal.
Hello, Anita. Happy to be here.
Great to have you. Thank you for doing this today. Pascal, we will talk about some of your work today. You wrote some articles about the future of banking and the future of money. And before we start, I would like to ask you, are you self-employed, or what did you do, or what are you doing at the moment, and how did you get into the Bitcoin space?
Yes, well, currently I'm actually employed. Yes, I work for a small company in Switzerland out of Zurich. It's called Financial Media AG, and it's an independent journalistic enterprise, I would call it. We're only four people, and we're focused on finance and economics and all these type of themes. And yes, I studied economics and political sciences at the University of Zurich. And that was also the time when I actually bumped into Bitcoin. But privately, when I was just reading and researching. And yes, then I got into the topic ever more deeply, and it just really fascinated me how, like so many others, you know, how there's a whole new thing, like a new paradigm, I would argue, emerging. So yes, I studied it ever more, also in Vienna, where you live. And yeah, it's really great. So that's why I started to go on this journey ever since.
And what would you say are the properties about Bitcoin that interest you the most? I mean, Bitcoin has so many different sides. What is the most interesting part for you?
Well, I would argue the most interesting part for me is that it just tries to be really different from many things we already know in the traditional world. You know, I probably like it for the many things many people dislike it, you know, so that it is a privately owned money, or a privately organized money, you know, in a more or less anarchic or like market anarchistic way, you know. That's what I really like about it. There's just a great community who comes together, and really it's a social phenomenon, you know, emergent, and it's not top down, it's more bottom up, and all these things that people usually don't really like when it comes to money, I find really interesting, not because I really dislike everything else that we have in the traditional world, you know. I also find really great comfort and also value in what we have in the more traditional world, as I would call it. But I find it really interesting to have an alternative as well, you know, because I'm also always thinking in alternatives. You know, the world is never just black and white, and it's not one easy solution that gets everything, and that is the all solution, or the solution to everything. So the more options we have, and with Bitcoin, I think we have another option when it comes to money, when it comes to potential a new financial system, to many, many things. You know, I think that's very interesting. Also, privacy is a topic that's associated with Bitcoin, you know, banking the unbanked and helping people who don't really get into the traditional financial system. All these things, you know, I find really interesting, and this is why I didn't stop looking at it so far.
Now with Bitcoin, we don't need banks anymore to send money around the world. But why is this important? What are the problems you see in the traditional banking system today?
Well, yeah, the problem with banking, I mean, there's, I would argue, the most pressing problem is a systematic one, you know, that banks, they're part of a greater thing, you know, which I would call the triumvirate, you know, of state, central banks and commercial banks, you know, and these kind of form the system today, the financial system. And, it is inclusive, but only to some extent, you know, that as I already, as I already mentioned, like many people are excluded from this system, you know, this I particularly mean people that are not from the first world, you know, that are people that live in other countries of the third world, and they have a really hard time getting into the system. But then also for us, the ones who are in the system, we might be lucky to be there and have really great banking solutions, you know, we're typically also overbanked. But these systems also become ever more pressing, you know, in the sense that they're are ever more, I would argue, they are a relevant part in our lives, you know, and they have all our wealth and much of our money and much of our lives depend on them, you know. And so I think, yeah, the more they are become relevant for us, the greater is also a possible downside to when the system maybe someday could fail or would fail, you know, and we never know if it really will fail. But, you know, life is just full of uncertainty. So I think it's really pressing that we also think about other things. And with the banking system, you know, as I experience it, you know, it reaches some limits also when it comes to scalability evermore, also within our system. I mean, nowadays I have just some personal anecdotes where I try to get something out of the bank. Just a couple of days ago, I wanted to get some old reports on monthly on the monthly transaction history with a bank I used to be at, and I'm not at this bank anymore. So I actually approached them and told them, hey, can I have these reports 2 years back? And then at the counter, the lady said, yeah, I'll have to check it. I was there for over 30 minutes. And I thought it can't be that hard to just get a spreadsheet, you know, and print it out and give it to me. And then after 30 minutes, when she got it, she was like, okay, and now you have to pay me 100 Swiss francs for 100 pages, you know, so 1 franc per page. And I was like, that can't be true, right? And she, that's true. So I said, okay, I'm not going to get this, you know. And this was just like a personal anecdote, but it showed me that the system is so really, I would say, it hit a peak, you know, where it's just, it's an old system that is not scalable anymore, that is just not really in favor of the customers anymore. And that just kind of lives off credit expansion, money expansions, how you probably have talked about on your podcast as well. So this is why I would say the banking system really needs to be reformed, you know, in a fundamental way. And there I see also Bitcoin playing a huge part.
Can we talk a little bit about this credit expansion and what the results are? I mean, as I understand it, it's the Cantillon effect, where the money flows to the people who are basically in the first row after the money being printed by the central banks. What do you think about these credit expansion? Because many people also say the system has to fail in the next years.
Yeah, well, I can't really say definitely whether it will fail or not, but it's certainly something that is really deteriorating, you know. I think the credit expansion, for me, it's always, sometimes when I talk to people, they blame it all on credit expansion and they see it as the greatest evil ever. And I would argue, no, maybe it's not, you know. I mean, credit, or that you can expand credit within an economic system, is also positive for me, you know, because it shows there's trust between people and trust between banks and people. And you can expand credit, and this is actually a good thing, you know. But to me, today, I think the way people look at credit expansion and the reason for why they think it's not such a great thing anymore. And it's actually a burden on society is because it's become like an institutionalized credit expansion, you know, of private, public banks, you know, central banks, what I would call like public banks, and then the privately owned banks, you know, which are the commercial banks. And then you also have the state who orchestrates everything, you know, and these entities, you know, they, it becomes like a credit expansion on its, for its own sake, you know, for eternal economic growth, you know, you have to expand money ever further. And as you mentioned, truly, this has some effects, you know, on society. You mentioned the Cantillon effect, where the ones that are really close to where the money is created get the money first, and they are then enriched because the ones that get the money later, they will already have to face higher prices and stuff, you know. So yeah, there are some like really redistributional effects to money creation, and I think you will never get it out of this world. There will always be problem. Nothing will be 100% perfect, you know. But today, because it's become such a great or institutionalized money creation, where also you have other negative effects coming from this, such as negative interest rates, you know, just huge like property prices and other prices, asset prices that leave many people out of the picture because they can't really save anymore and stuff. You know, this is really something like that is institutional. Some people even call it legal plunder, you know. I don't know if I would go this far, but it's just something I think is not right anymore. And this is why I would consider this credit expansion to be a rather negative thing today, yes.
And how could Bitcoin be an alternative here? I mean, Bitcoin has a fixed limit, we know that, but many people say, okay, but then we can't control the money flowing in or out. So a nation state can't control its own monies. How can Bitcoin be a help here?
We will probably only see this in the future, you know, and I can't really know. I don't really have a crystal ball I would love it, you know, but I think the way it will probably go about is that Bitcoin will just be some kind of check, you know, on the traditional world. You know, I think there are problems to Bitcoin as well. You mentioned the thing with this capped supply, you know, where it's kind of hard when demand comes in that the supply cannot really react to this demand, you know, which will always, to my understanding, create some volatility. And this because Bitcoin might always be a little more volatile than other things in the short term, it will also have a hard time to be really adopted as the general means of payment, you know. So there I see some tensions, you know, that the real like great economy could establish on Bitcoin. But still, I mean, to many people in the world, Bitcoin is still more stable than things they get from their government. You know, think of states in the third world, you know, that are just really not having great currencies, you know, and to them, Bitcoin is even a better alternative than their means of payment, you know. And for us over here in the Western world, who maybe at this point in time, at least have a stable currencies, you know, for us, it's an empowerment of the saver, because I would argue in our Western world, people really get you know, disenfranchised because they don't really have a good way to save anymore. You know, they're already in Germany. I read this morning, there are already 41 banks that charge negative interest rates, you know. And I mean, when you are in the financial system again and you have your colleagues working at banks, you might be able to buy up property and other assets, you know, this can kind of save you. But for a normal saver, you know, who don't really has access to these kinds of instruments, he's just really at the whim of central banks and banking today, where, as we already mentioned, the financial repression is getting ever more harsher, you know. And this way, I see Bitcoin as a way to kind of opt out, you know, and just say, hey, there's another system, something that can be inflated, that is maybe not so correlated to the traditional world. And this way, I see it as a check, that people just fleeing the old world because they don't can't stand it anymore and they can't take it anymore. And this way, the old world also has, or the traditional world, I would argue, has to overthink what they are doing. And maybe this check in the form of Bitcoin challenges them to be more cautious and maybe rethink their whole policies again. You know, that's at least what I would say I hope for.
Yeah, I hope for too. But sometimes I think this is wishful thinking. I mean, maybe we are too early, but I mean, Bitcoin was the first of a new kind, a real cryptocurrency. But what we see now is that most people or the major organizations as such, they all want to build their own stable coins, tokens, and more. And also, we know that central banks are planning their own digital currencies. I don't know how they call it then, digital currencies, because it's not a cryptocurrency, actually. Are we not going into another direction? I mean, is it just a small percentage of people like you and me who can see what Bitcoin can be or is, and all the others are doing as usual? I mean, just going into a future where everything might be optimized, but the basic stays the same?
Yeah, that's obviously a good point. And I'm also struggling with this as well. You know, it's true. I mean, there is an Austrian economist, Josef Schumpeter. He once said that, like, the monetary system is also a reflection of society's state of mind, you know, and then maybe not the other way around. So we could argue that the system, the monetary system we have today, is because of us humans who just think this way, you know, and who really indulge in credit expansion and don't want to have it any other way, you know. So this is certainly a great risk, you know, and I think, yeah, it's true. People, they don't really... they see no value in Bitcoin. I usually get asked over here in Europe, why do you even care? I mean, everything is so great, you know. But then I say, yeah, maybe as long as they don't need it, they won't really see any benefit, and they don't have to, you know. But maybe this could change, you know. I always bring the example that even Germany, which was a really like well-established state, you know, they went down the path many decades ago that we would have never thought that they would go down this path, you know. And I think we're not in a state today where we can never experience anything like this, you know. I don't know what's going to happen in 30 years, how Switzerland, how Austria and all these places are going to look like. And I can imagine that the economy can really get tougher. And I mean, then people would probably look for alternatives, you know. And I think it's also on an individual level, you know, maybe we don't have to think in these mass adoption scenarios, you know, and get as many people as possible. Do it individually. Talk to people, you know. I had friends who told me I have to pay a programmer in Pakistan and I don't get the dollars over there because they always get resent. And every time they get resent, I pay $40 for nothing. Then I told them about Bitcoin and they did it in Bitcoin and it just magically worked, you know. And then it was like, okay, now I see a use case. And I think these things on an individual scale can really drive people to this sort of adoption. It might not be a mass adoption, but it'd be one person at a time, you know. And I also maybe think that it's also maybe people that are, you know, I would say like asset managers and people who manage money on behalf of everybody else, you know, they might be the ones that will discover Bitcoin at some point. And when they then start to invest and stuff, this will also have an impact, you know, because then Bitcoin will get ever stronger and the strength will not come from us individuals directly, but by these people who manage. And then you can also say again, okay, but then is somebody else who manages Bitcoin for you? Yes, fair enough. But still, they are going into Bitcoin, and with Bitcoin increasing in market cap, it becomes ever more relevant. And this way, it could still have an effect on society. But I'm totally with you. I mean, it's a long way to go, and people, that's also what I always struggle with, that maybe mankind's mind is really not made for Bitcoin.
Maybe not yet. Maybe it's just too difficult to grasp in a short time, you know. I mean, I also needed, I think after the first 2 or 3 months, I thought, okay, now I understood. Now after 3 years, I know I have something to learn every day in Bitcoin. So Bitcoin was the start. And last year we saw Libra, like Facebook wants to build its own currency. Libra. I think they also have the slogan banking the unbanked. What comes to mind in your head when you hear Libra or Facebook saying we want to bank the unbanked?
Well, I find it rather ambiguous, you know, because I mean, Facebook, it's a private company, and I mean, they have done great things, you know, for us. I mean, I use Facebook still almost every day, you know, and I wouldn't like demonize them and say they're the worst thing ever on this planet, you know, but they're a privately owned company. There are human beings behind it. So where human beings are, there are failures. And we know with Facebook, there are many failures, and it's just so really in the news because it's such a big company who handles so many data of all of the data of so many of us, you know. So I think they have some responsibility. We can surely say this and argue for this. And then when you see that Facebook time and time again has not really shown greatest respect for this, you know, and I saw some videos how like Mark Zuckerberg on TV said something that he will never do this. And then maybe 3 or 4 years later, he did it. You're like, okay, please just be quiet next time, you know, because you never know what you're going to do in 4 years. But this just shows, you know, that like whenever something gets really big, you know, and it is in centralized power, there are problems, you know. And then also when we think of Libra as being a currency, it was described as a cryptocurrency, but to someone who like at least somehow understands Bitcoin, recognizes Libra is not really a decentralized currency. There is a consortium of enterprises who is behind that. And there might be some problems to this as well. But maybe the most pressing thing that comes to my mind when I think about Libra is that it's just an extension of fiat. You know, I call it fiat 2.0, you know, because essentially Libra token is then just the interface that you use as a user, and behind it is the old same money system based on central banks and I would argue on state money, you know, fiat money, which is based by government bonds, you know. And this is also how Libra is going to be structured, you know. You're going to have this reserve fund, you know, this basket, consisted of US government bonds. And so far they want to have other bonds as well, but maybe it will only get launched with US government bonds, you know. But then you have to see that like the whole demand for Libra is just a demand for government bonds in the end, you know. And then you could say this is kind of prophetic, you know, because like whenever like a saver in the third world uses Libra, all he does is he's pouring his savings into a government bond of the first world, which I would say enriches the first world again, because they can offload their debt even to these people down there, you know. And then we could say it could be some monetary colonialism, you know, because I think colonialism wasn't only bad for the people down there, but it wasn't just good, you know. There's always like the bad and the good together, but I would just be more cautious, you know, by saying, look, we are going to bank the unbanked and everything is just going to be fine. There are always trade-offs, and I already see these trade-offs with Libra as well, you know.
Yeah, I think it's a massive trade-off for underdeveloped countries, because as you said, if all the people there put their money into Libra because it's so convenient, it's more stable than their own national currency, then all the financial power drains out of the country and into a private-owned company. I mean, the same is true for Bitcoin. We could also argue and say, okay, if people buy Bitcoin, then their local currency or their nation-state currency drains out into Bitcoin. But at least this is an open financial system and not privately owned. So I guess the benefit should be for the whole of the economy again, the whole Bitcoin ecosystem economy.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's always these trade-offs that you mentioned now, you know. I mean, you could argue that people can then use like Libra, which is maybe more stable, and they can have a whole like a known balance sheet from which they can then like stably make transactions and also like build up some kind of merchandise or just become economically relevant. You know, maybe this is the case, but maybe it's not, you know, and we just don't know yet. But it's whenever something is so politicized how it is today, I mean, it's always either good or bad, you know, Libra. And yeah, I just see there's always traders, and we just have to think about this and also mention these and debate these, that people, when they like have the option of entering Libra, that they know what this whole thing comes with, you know, that they are not buying the cat in the bag or something.
Yeah, I mean, I was researching the other day about cryptocurrencies in Africa. I mean, Africa is very big, of course, but I mean, by the time that this episode is published, I'm going to be in Zimbabwe and Botswana. And I heard that some people there might found a Africa coin or something like a Pan-African cryptocurrency. And I'm really curious what they think about or what they are planning. And you were also talking about tokenization before. With this tokenization, it seems that, I mean, we have these, I think, two parts in the Bitcoin and blockchain community. On the one hand, you have people who say Bitcoin, not blockchain. And on the other hand, we have people who only talk about blockchain or DLT. The second group very often also talks about tokenization, like tokenizing all various forms of assets, from fiat money to real estate, etc. And very often it's also said that's a good thing because it's democratization of financial instruments. So everybody now can be a part and can gain interest or profits on real estate, for instance. Isn't it a usual outcome in a free market that when there is high interest for an asset, the price is rising? So then it's again not wealth increasing for the small people. What do you think about that?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, again, there are trade-offs to this as well. You know, I see, I mean, tokenization generally, I'm neither in one nor the other camp. You know, I really like what's going on Bitcoin. I would say Bitcoin, yes, but I would also say don't say no to blockchain and everything else that is coming along with it, you know, but be critical all the long or anyways, you know. But sure, I mean, tokenization, I don't know. I mean, I see some benefits also, as you already mentioned, you know, in Africa, maybe some local communities, you know, who could like with a new technology, you know, use this some kind of public blockchain as a base layer and on top of this issue their tokens that represent like stuff from their local economy. You know, I know a person, he has a foundation called Purini Foundation, and they're also working in Zimbabwe and trying to bootstrap a local economy there, you know, with their Purini token that would really help these people, you know, get something started, you know. And maybe you have the aspect of social money, you know, where money is not really like a global ledger or something, but it's still something that's really down to a social community, you know, and it just only circulates in this community. And it's some kind of, it's not even a real money. It's just something that enables a better barter economy, you know, in a social, like a clan or like a little bigger society or something. And there I would say, don't really write off technology just yet, you know. Maybe it can help. I don't know. I haven't really been there, and I'm only reading about this and trying to think about this in my head. But yeah, we don't know. But obviously, with the big things, especially with technology, if something is really global and it's easily accessible, like Bitcoin, yeah, I mean, many people want in on the action, and then the price rises. And again, you know, that's always a counter argument I hear. Now Bitcoin is worth 90,000 Swiss francs or dollars or something? And can I even buy a Bitcoin? Yes, with Bitcoin, you can pay a fraction of it, but still then you only get a fraction, you know, and the ones that like entered at the beginning are the ones that are off the best, you know, but that's always dynamics of this world. And I think you will never be able to erase them altogether, you know, but yeah, I mean, I don't know. I see it all again. There are some pros and cons to tokenization and blockchain.
Mm. What do you think about stable coins? Can stable coins really be stable?
Yeah, it's also a really interesting question. If they can really be stable, I mean, in the short run, they maybe can. In the long run, I mean, nothing is really stable. From an economic point of view, you have to argue that, I mean, even like, fiat money, you know, is maybe stable when it comes to everyday transactions. But if you take a longer time horizon, you see that like fiat money, even the Swiss franc, which is considered to be a really great currency, you know, is not stable at all. It loses value on a concurrent basis, you know. And then stable, yeah, when it comes to currencies, I mean, there are many interesting ideas on how to make them stable, you know, in relation to goods, you know. And I'm rather skeptical if this will really work in the long term if you have not the power that a central bank has, you know, who eventually is backed by the law as well and really has the power to issue its own money. And even when push comes to shove, it can like really force it onto the people, you know. So with a stable coin, I mean, yeah, it's just, or maybe also like a trust issue, you know, when you can like reliably tell your people that use your stablecoin, look, we can make sure that we always have enough reserves to keep like the stablecoin stable in reference to some state currency. Yeah, then maybe you can. Like uplift this sort of illusion, I would call it. But yeah, I don't know if a stablecoin really works in the end. But so far, it seems to work. And I think there's also some great benefits to it for people in countries like Venezuela and stuff. That's at least what I heard. Again, I haven't really been there myself, so it's just what I hear. But I can imagine that these kind of instruments can already have some benefits to some people, you know.
So Bitcoin and Libra definitely gave some kind of tailwind to the development of central bank digital currencies. Do you believe that these digital currencies from central banks could disrupt commercial banking?
That's something that's really discussed nowadays, and many people hold it as a given that CBDCs will be launched within the next few years. I myself, I'm not so sure, you know, because eventually if you have a CBDC, I think, you know, and you're launching it through the central banks and you're also allowing like regular citizens to have an account at the central bank, you know, then we would have what we could call like a sovereign money system, you know, we call it in German Vollgeldsystem. And I'm really not sure if a central bank really wants to have such a system, you know, because I mean, the system today, it kind of functions the way that like money creation is offloaded to the commercial banks, you know, and this way they can also kind of decentralize the risk and decentralize like the process of money creations, because then the bank have to make sure that whoever they give credit to, that these creditors or debtors are actually, you know, really having enough means to pay back the loan, you know, so they can really offload this whole work to the commercial banks. And if you have a CBDC that is really launched as a Vollgeld system, as a sovereign money, then everything would be turned upside down, you know. And so far, so I'm not really sure if central banks really want to go down this route. Maybe they issue a CBDC just because they see that like normal cash, you know, actual cash is on the demise and nobody's using it anymore. And then they launch this CBDC also through the commercial banks, you know, then nothing really would change. It would just be that you have no cash anymore, and the cash would be the CBDC, but it's still launched through commercial banks, privately owned banks, you know. So yeah, it is also something I don't really know where it's going to be, but I just see both sides, and I don't think it's so easy to have an answer just yet.
It's definitely not easy to foresee the future. Nonetheless, what do you think, which kind of developments are we going to see in the next 5 years, let's say in the Bitcoin space and in other monies?
Well, yeah, so the future of money is probably the most interesting topic nowadays, and it's also the most interesting time to be alive, because I think so much is changing, you know, because I would argue our traditional monetary system is really at a crossroads, you know, it's really, there could be like potential disruption happening, and not only from outside, but really from within, you know, because the system is over leveraged. It's just reached peak centralization and peak expansion, and something has to give, you know, and I don't really know what it is, but I can imagine that things could change rapidly and also like radically, you know. We also talk about MMT, you know, the modern monetary theory when it comes to economics and changing the monetary system. It's gaining a lot of traction in the US, you know, because politicians mainly see it as a way to get the credit expansion like in a more direct way, right from the state, without having a central bank and privately owned banks who have to buy like government bonds from government, and on this way like the private bankers can enrich themselves, because they are the ones again that get all the interest and stuff. So this is also something that I hear particularly from the left, people who say, hey, we need to have the MMT because it's a more just system, you know, more direct and stuff. And I could imagine that this could really happen, maybe not in the next 2 or 3 years, but maybe in the next 10 to 12 years. I don't know, you know. And what I would see then is just that money would be, or like the traditional fiat currencies, you know, they, in my mind, would become ever more worthless, you know, because then they're just like a number somewhere on a spreadsheet. They are already today, but today you still have like private banks who have to, as I already mentioned, you know, like struggle with debtors, you know, to see whether when they give out credit that these debtors pay back the loan, you know. And in the other system, this might be loosened up, you know, and then money would become more worthless, I would say, you know. It will lose its value even faster and even greater. And this way, I think, this would be the reason for other money systems like Bitcoin and this decentralized currency, you know, to gain more traction, because people, they just hold some of their money in the traditional fiat, but because it's losing value and they are all on a race to a bottom, they also diversify into Bitcoin and potential other assets, you know. I already mentioned this thing with social money, you know, that you will have smaller and smaller communities that find each other, like these filter bubbles we find on social media today, where like many people, or like a group of people, they just meet in a group of Facebook and they talk to each other and they just live within this bubble. This could also maybe happen to money, because technology enables this, you know, that people really have this little barter economy going on within them, you know, enhanced through the digital means. And yeah, this is maybe some ways I could see things happening, you know, and also just maybe with tokenization, that shares and gold and other assets could become more money-like again, because they are represented by a token that can be like sent around more easily. And this could also be something that people go to, you know, as a flight maybe from the fiat system losing out ever more. So these would be the tendencies I see.
Exciting times ahead. I think you also wrote a book about all these things, did you?
Yes, exactly. Yes, I also wrote a book. It's called Ignore at Your Own Risk, The New Decentralized World of Bitcoin and Blockchain. And yeah, there we touched on all these topics, you know, first and foremost on what Bitcoin is and how it's going to change society. Is it gold? Is it nothing? Is it money? All these questions. But then also, you know, what effects it's going to have on society? How is the state going to be affected? And then we also talk about Ethereum, which I also find interesting, you know, for all these applications that it is known for, you know. And we just, it's really like an educational book with some personal opinions wrapped into the book, you know, trying to filter out where things could go. Also, I always say everyone, even to myself, what I write, I have to take with a grain of salt, you know, because as we already mentioned, we don't know where the world is going. But yeah, this is what we're trying to do in this book, you know, educational content for people who really are interested in what philosophical, economic, political, and even psychological questions are brought up with Bitcoin. And many of these questions are being asked again. This is really what I like, you know, because when I was at university, you couldn't talk about money, privately owned money, and all these things that we talk about today with Bitcoin. Nobody cared about them. But now, at least, they maybe come for making a quick buck, you know, because they see Bitcoin is going up. And many of the people, they leave the system again when the price falls. But two or three people, they stay and they stick for the interesting questions. And this is really what I like. And this is also who the book is for, people who want to know more on what this thing is all about, you know.
Is it published in English already?
Yes, we also have it in English. We have it in German and in English.
Okay, great. I will put it in the show notes then. Do you have other reading recommendations for our listeners, for Bitcoin enthusiasts and newbies?
Well, there's so much. I mean, I know that you have written a book. You've translated, I think, the book by Andreas Antonopoulos, if I'm right, or you help translate, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I'm part of the team. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. I mean, these books are great. I learned so much from Andreas as well. You know, he's been a great influence in our book. You know, we even have comics in our book where Andreas Antonopoulos is also like a comic figure, you know, where we not only try to tell the content with words, but also in pictures and images. So this is kind of interesting. But I mean, other books, I mean, there's so much out there. At the top of my head, or I don't know what to tell you now, but I mean, people can always reach out to me if they want to know more on a particular topic. I mean, that's what I can say. I read all day long. It's part of my journalistic job. It's part of my life as a personal being, you know, as a lifelong student, as you introduced me. So that's all I can say. I have pretty big overview when it comes to literature. So whenever somebody wants to know something, just hit me up and I can try to find it with you and try to help you and give you like literature recommendation, because reading is just really one of my biggest things I do all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, reading is great. Now I'm going to shill my own podcast book recommendation site where we'll also put your book. It's nice. On bitcoinandco.com/en/books, I believe. Okay, we're coming to an end now. Pascal, thank you very much. Please let us know where people can find and follow you.
I'm on Twitter. At Pahuk is my Twitter handle. And yes, I'm all over the internet, I would argue, or I try to. But I mean, we also financial media or 10x10.ch is our website where you can sign up to our newsletter and Facebook, LinkedIn. Just hit me up. But maybe the best place is Twitter, where I'm happy to talk to you, happy to talk about everything, answer any questions. Yes, I'm always trying to learn myself. And this is what I recognize. Whenever you talk to people, you learn the most yourself. You know, that's great.
Thank you very much for this chat and for your time. And I hope I will see you at one of the Bitcoin conferences, maybe in the future, but we'll definitely stay in touch. Bye.
Bye. Thank you very much, Anita. And also keep it up. Your work really great. And yeah, maybe we'll see each other. I think we'll be soon. Great.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you liked my show, please subscribe to it in your podcast player and share the episode on social media. You can find all links that were mentioned in the show notes on the website or in your podcast player. You can contact me also on Twitter, LinkedIn or YouTube. Goodbye from Vienna, auf Wiederhören. Music, Start With Yes, Delicate Beats. Idea, Content and Production, yours truly, Anita Posch.